Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Leona Brando. I am the founder of New Vision Organization and host of Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Today, we will be again welcoming our guest, Lynn Nanos, to the part two series of her book on breakdown. Lynn is a licensed social worker, author, and active member of the National Shattering Silence Coalition that advocates for the mentally ill population. Lynn shared with us last week some of her knowledge and many experiences she has had in working with the most vulnerable and less fortunate individuals in society, the mentally ill men, women, and at times children. Today she will be shedding more light on her knowledge and experiences in working with the mentally ill and speak more on her unique and informative book, a topic that has been the downfall and stumbling block for so many individuals, their friends and their loved ones in society. There have been large populations of homelessness, suicides, homicides, and many other serious problems resulting from untreated serious mental and psychological issues. Let's welcome Lynn back to provide more insight into her interesting book, Breakdown, A Clinician's Experience in a Broken System of Emergency Psychiatrists. Lynn, we welcome you back, and we are anxious to hear more about your unique book on Breakdown.
Hi, Leona. Thank you again for having me report on this extremely important topic. I'm very happy to be here. I want to delve into some details about the book, including the reform initiatives of the book. So, Breakdown, A Clinician's Experience in a Broken System of Emergency Psychiatry, calls for the following reform initiatives that I'd like to elaborate a bit on. So, the first is a lot of patients that I've evaluated in mobile emergency services fake being ill, and the prevalence of this in emergency services is astounding. And they literally take inpatient and crisis stabilization unit beds away from the patients who truly need help. Now, of course, there are exceptions. For instance, I have oftentimes granted inpatient and or crisis stabilization unit beds to those who malinger. In other words, malingering does not automatically mean that no help is needed. However, the vast majority of those who malinger often get enabled by the system. Inpatient units are more likely to accept someone malingering over a highly psychotic patient who is uncooperative and prone to violence because of discrimination, and the malingering patient is oftentimes seen as easy to deal with. The malingering patient wants to be there, albeit for the wrong reasons. And I have found that the majority of these patients have problems with substance abuse. And the problem is that they have been granted inpatient and crisis stabilization units quite inappropriately, which enables them and makes them keep on coming back. Another reform initiative involves the need for the federal government to repeal the Institutions for Mental Diseases Exclusion Law. This law was a part of deinstitutionalization and has existed since 1965. It prohibits the federal government from financially reimbursing Medicaid for inpatient psychiatric facilities with more than 16 beds for patients aged 21 and in certain circumstances 22 up to 64 years old, otherwise known as the IMD exclusion. It discriminates against the seriously mentally ill population who are more likely than the rest of the population who are mentally ill to need government-funded inpatient care. So although this past November, the federal government made it less difficult for states to access waivers, a full repeal is still needed. The waivers involve a lot of loopholes and can be quite difficult to enact. The next initiative involves the severe shortage of inpatient psychiatric beds. Since the 1950s, there has been over 96% decline in the number of inpatient beds, despite that the population in the United States has increased. So because there are so few inpatient beds, the emergency rooms end up backlogged and a lot of patients, again, especially those who are more challenging, end up waiting inappropriately long for inpatient beds to open and for the inpatient units to accept them. So there is a severe shortage of inpatient beds. The next reform initiative I'd like to discuss is the discrimination that a lot of inpatient, if not all inpatient units, impose against the most challenging cases. A breakdown suggests that the governments impose consequences on these units for the discrimination that occurs. Here's an excerpt from Breakdown. Inpatients are more likely to decline for admission those patients who don't want help, who are violent, who have no payment source, or who will likely need lengthy inpatient courses. When I worked on an inpatient unit, I accidentally overheard two administrators discussing their priority to remind the admissions department not to admit any patient who's, quote, homeless, hard to place, going to be stuck here forever, going to seriously hurt one of us, end quote. Inpatient units should be held legally accountable for this type of discrimination because these are the patients who need inpatient admission the most. And these are the types of patients who certainly need a lot more help than those who malinger. Again, I certainly don't want to generalize and state that everyone who malingers does not need inpatient, but the majority of malingerers do not need inpatient. The next reform initiative involves the barriers that the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, otherwise known as HIPAA, impose on treatment plans. Now, HIPAA is a much bigger problem on inpatient units than in emergency services. In emergency services, when an involuntary hold is in place, HIPAA can be thrown out the window. HIPAA is not really an issue when safety is the top priority, and I have determined that the patient needs inpatient, regardless of whether she or he wants this. I am allowed to contact family members, friends, outpatient providers, regardless of whether the patient wants this. So obtaining input from collateral sources is critical. It's extremely important. And on inpatient units, HIPAA poses more of a problem because discharge planning is a lot more intensive, and breakdown suggests that when a patient on inpatient has anosognosia, which is, again, the lack of awareness of being ill, is psychotic, and whose judgment is so impaired that that it hinders progress, two psychiatrists can sign off on an exemption by which the treatment team is allowed to contact family members and any other collateral sources for the sole purpose of safe discharge planning. The sixth one is the promotion of assisted outpatient treatment. This is a huge piece in the book, and it relates to how more than half of those with bipolar and schizophrenia have anosognosia. And when anosognosia is in the picture, inevitably the patient will not want treatment. It makes sense that in such cases, the professionals and the courts should really step in and do for the patient what the patient cannot do for her or himself. Assisted outpatient treatment, in a nutshell, ensures outpatient treatment compliance, and for the most part, it involves the patient going before a judge. This judge says to the patient, look, we have noticed a pattern here. Whenever you have not taken your medication, you have ended up hospitalized, and I am ordering you to attend all your outpatient appointments, take your medication. And according to research studies, this is shown to be very effective. It's called the black robe effect. And it simply means that patients are more likely to listen to a judge than anyone else, because the judge is in a position of authority and is wearing a black robe, which looks highly official. And assisted outpatient treatment has shown to reduce rates of homelessness, violence, incarcerations, and readmissions to hospitals. And it has also shown to improve overall self-care. And this is allowed in all states and Washington, D.C., except for Massachusetts, Maryland, and Connecticut. So these are the only three states that do not allow this, despite that in recent years it has become normalized and the controversy of it has significantly declined. And I expect that the three remaining states will eventually follow suit. And I'm expecting to testify before the Massachusetts legislation later this year in support of an AOT bill. So I'm looking forward to that opportunity. Moving on to the next reform initiative, there are some organizations that tout the belief that mental illness does not exist or that minimize the severity of mental illness. And Breakdown describes one in Massachusetts called Recovery Learning Communities. Unfortunately, the government funds this organization. A very concerning example of them minimizing the seriousness of mental illness is when they conducted a class which supported people wanting to stop taking their medications. And Breakdown describes and compares civil commitment criteria from state to state. Each state has its own civil commitment law. And unfortunately, these are overly restrictive in many states, making it very, very difficult for sickest of the sick to get admitted to inpatient units. Mm-hmm. And this is especially true for those with psychosis and anosognosia. Finally, as I touched upon a bit last week, I make a case for borderline personality disorder and its severity. The severity of this disorder warrants that it be classified as a serious mental illness. And although the National Institute on Mental Health referred to it as serious, the DSM-5, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the Bible of psychiatry, as most people know, it still refers to it as a personality disorder. And the DSM-4 classified it as a minor disorder. And this very much has shaped our thinking and view of it. I believe it's telling that it is the most researched personality disorder out there. And this is because it is extremely common in clinical settings. It's the most common disorder among personality disorders seen in clinical settings. And people with this disorder are at high risk for accidentally killing themselves. They are extremely self-destructive, and 10% of them die from suicide. So that summarizes all the reform initiatives. What are your thoughts about that, Leona?
You know, it's very interesting because, as they say, there's an epidemic in this country, and there are so many that are so dysfunctional. But what you mentioned about the government and some of these programs that they don't want to take in, or they don't want to keep those that are in the streets, the homeless shelters, places like that. And those are the ones, as you say, they definitely need that help. And to be deprived because of their status, you know, being homeless, to me, it's not something that should be happening. It's almost like discriminating against mentally ill because they don't have the funds to pay, and taking in the ones that do have the funds who can go to private rehabilitation programs or residential treatment programs.
Yeah, it's alarming. It's disgusting. It is astonishing that the inpatient units are allowed to do this. They are never held legally accountable for this type of discrimination. And it's very ironic that those who need the most help are turned away.
You also touched on something else that was of interest, and I see this happening an awful lot too. There are a lot that maybe are not as severe as others, or maybe it's the addictions that they have instead of the mental illnesses. But it just goes to show you that there is a terrible need, an enormous need, for more long-term residential treatment programs, whether they be for psychological issues or whether they be for addictions. And I find there's a lot of people who turn to some kind of substance to try to block out pain that they have gone through, or try to block out something that has caused them to be dysfunctional. So there is a need in this country for more rehabilitation programs, especially for the mentally ill. And those who are addicted, again, they should have something for them as well. But not to open more facilities, to me, is not caring.
I agree with you that it seems there is not enough long-term residential programs. A very common discharge plan in state hospitals involves arrangements for the patients to get discharged to state-funded residential programs. And the waiting time for beds to open up is too long, just because there aren't enough residential programs. And I have heard this from friends that work on state-funded inpatient units, and have also encountered my own patients who have reported the length of time it took to get into residential programs. And in regards to the illicit drugs and alcohol that are used, breakdown does not delve too much into substance abuse. The most substance abuse is in the malingering chapter. When someone is drug intoxicated, it's close to impossible, if not impossible, to determine if there is an underlying mental illness, because the street drugs cover up who the person really is. But of course, dual diagnosis, that is, for those of you who don't know, the combination of mental illness and substance abuse is quite rampant, and the rate of both of these problems occurring together is quite high. But the reason I do not delve into substance abuse so much in breakdown is that the true person is covered up when there are illicit drugs or alcohol on board.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. As you say, it's hard to determine in a situation like that.
Yes, yes. So when faced with someone abusing drugs, it's important to get a history and learn the timing of the symptoms of mental illness. In other words, if it's revealed that symptoms of mental illness occurred before the onset of abusing drugs or during lengthy periods of sobriety, then I can conclude that there is a true underlying mental illness there.
Yeah. But I really believe more facilities need to be established, and I think they need to be long-term, because what's happening right now is the facilities they have are just not working. And I don't know if it's because they're not actually using all their resources to help these people, or they're not appropriate resources. But, Lynn, I have to say, we're going to be closing pretty soon, and I wanted to let everyone know that we will be having the third part series next Wednesday, February 27th, at the same time, 4:30. And, Lynn, if you can, just, again, give your website where they can order the books or at least review it.
Sure, sure. The website is quite easy to remember. It's just lynnnanos.com. So lynnnanos.com. And the digital and paperback versions are available at all major online stores.
Okay, great. So we thank everyone for being with us today. And again, next week we will be hearing more from Lynn Nanos, and her books can be found at the website given. And we thank you so much, Lynn, for being with us today again and for filling us in, shedding light on all of these different types of situations. We really appreciate your being with us. And again, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And we will be closing now.
Great.
Thank you,
bye-bye.
Everyone. Bye-bye.